good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hope you all slept well. This is a nice, peaceful place, isn't it? I rather like that room without any things that glowed in it or anything like that. I was really grateful yesterday in our Bible study time for the time that we spent naming the powers. It was good. It was good to hear from the places where y'all are what the powers are that you see and what some of the characteristics of those powers are. I feel a lot of those with you. I think every one of those I feel in some ways. I think we got it naming some of the things that that all of us are facing in this world and in the broken systems of our world. And what I would like to do in our time this morning is to talk about, there's two powers. I think they're powers, or there's some manifestations of the powers in our current context that that I and our community have spent some time paying attention to. And both this morning and this afternoon, I'd like to do a little bit of storytelling and a little bit of kind of mining those stories for what the Spirit is stirring in response to those powers. The powers I want to name, I just thought I'd go ahead and tell you, are speed and placelessness. I think these are incredible powers in our time. The power of speed and the power of placelessness. I talked a little bit yesterday about how I have this sense that one of the overarching struggles of the soul of our world right now is this disconnection between our spirituality and the stuff of life. I think this has a lot to do with the forms of faith that emerged out of the modern world, and I think these things have come to a crisis point because of all of the manifestations of unsustainability that we see around us. Whether it's the unsustainability of our environment and the crisis of global climate change and the fact that, you know, we're starting to feel global warming. We sure are down in Durham. I had a conversation with a neighbor the other day about global warming. I thought, Lord, I never thought this would happen. one of my neighbors who doesn't really listen in on, you know, the conversations that are happening in academia. But I said, Lord, it's hot today. She said, it sure is. I think it's that global warming. My goodness. Sorry. The trouble is, I would encourage you on this point to read Bill McKibben's new book. It's called Earth, but it's spelled with two A's. You're probably supposed to pronounce that differently, but I don't know how Bill pronounces it. But anyway, what he says in that book is that we have a planet that is recognizably the same planet, but that actually isn't the planet that we've learned to sustain civilization on for the past 5,000 years. The planet has changed in the last 50 years, and it will never be the same again. So he talks in that book about how do we make life on this strange new planet possible. And that's an important question. This is those kind of sustainability questions. But after 10 years of being at war, there's also this huge financial sustainability question that this country's facing. And if you think we're facing it here in terms of how to balance the budget, you ought to just talk to people in Afghanistan. After 10 years of suffering the war, they're asking desperate questions about sustainability. And so on lots of fronts, we see that the systems of our world are broken in such a way that the powers are dealing death, and it manifests itself in concrete things that make us realize life can't go on like this. Life can't go on in the way that it has. And my sense is that this, all of this has something to do with our divorce from the dirt that we were made out of, from the land beneath our feet, from places that we belong to. And so I've been doing some reflecting on why it matters where we live. Because I'm both a person who likes to talk, but also a person who likes to write, I brought a piece that I've written that, if you will indulge me, I'd like to read you this little piece on why it matters where we live, as a reflection this morning on the power of placelessness and the resources that our tradition offers us for engaging that power. And the particular community that I want to focus on here is a community in Philadelphia called New Jerusalem Now. So you'll get several glimpses of this community, but it's a beautiful place. So why it matters where we live. Take the elevated train north from Philadelphia's center city, and you soon find yourself in an industrial wasteland. Old factory buildings are surrounded by boarded-up row houses, interrupted by empty lots where plastic bags from corner stores roll like tumbleweeds. You might mistake some blocks here for a ghost town, except for the ceaseless noise that arises from the chaotic lives of people who are not so much ghosts as dead men walking. Lives abandoned when everyone who could get out of this place did. The souls who were left to scrounge in these ruins eke out their existence from plastic wrappers and brown paper bags. Heroin has left so many of their eyes hollow that they mostly look down or through you when you pass them on the street. The train car rattles away overhead, stirring a wind at your back that brings with it the smell of urine mixed with dust. You have come to an abandoned place. In the midst of this urban desert, on Norris Street, a sign hangs over a simple door proclaiming, "New Jerusalem Now." Here the sidewalk is swept clean. If you follow it past the house, you can see a garden in full bloom, flowers surrounding Swiss chard and heirloom variety tomatoes ripe on the vine. An inner city oasis, this community is home to a couple of religious sisters and 50 recovering addicts. They begin their day with an hour of group Bible study, followed by household chores and 2.5 hours of community service. Members of the community feed their neighbors, tend the garden, run a small biodiesel station, and offer alternative to violence seminars. In the living room where they study scripture, there's a sign on the wall. I love it. It says, "My recovery will never be complete until I help the society that made me sick to heal." For these brothers and sisters, healing begins on Norris Street. The new life they seek is not far away in a land they dream of, but right here in the abandoned places they call home. Though this street has been overlooked by city government, redlined by lenders, avoided by real estate agents, and preyed on by hucksters, God is present on Norris Street. It's not just a feeling that some people have here. You can see it. "I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God," the Apostle John writes in his Revelation. If you listen closely to the people who are finding new life at New Jerusalem Now, they echo the declaration that accompanied John's vision. God's dwelling is now among the people. From the very beginning of the story of God's people, the promise of life with God is tied to a place on earth. God's promise to make Abraham into a great nation is not only a promise of children, but also of land. "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." Conviction about promised land gives rise to the agony of Israel's exile. How can we sing the songs of Zion when we're in a foreign land? Relationship with God is so connected to relationship with the land that Israel cannot initially imagine worship in a new and foreign place. But the crisis of dislocation does not sever Israel's connection to place. It radically redefines it. I think this is important for us in an age of placelessness. "Seek the peace of the city to which I've carried you into exile." You know that line from Jeremiah. Place matters, but Israel learns in Babylon that their God can hallow any ground. "Indeed, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." When we pay attention to our story, the centrality of our place on earth emerges as an essential element of what it means to be the people of God's promise. But we are not accustomed to being a place people. For all of the ways our story ties us to the ground from which we're made and the particular places where our God has met us, we also live in a culture of placelessness. We pride ourselves in being global citizens, right? We know more about what's happening in New York and Tokyo than we know about the contours of the watershed in which we live and move and feed our children. While local culture may seem quaint, especially when we're on vacation, I mentioned to y'all the other day that I'm from this place down the road from Mount Airy, North Carolina, which is where Mayberry. It's amazing to go to Mount Airy and to see the nostalgia and the tourist industry that's built around the nostalgia of Mayberry. Tour buses come in there every day to go to Opie's Candy Shop and eat, you know, lunch at the little place there where Andy used to eat lunch, and to get their hair cut at Floyd's Barbershop. It's all there, but it's mostly just there for the tourists. We like local culture when we're on vacation. But the ways and means of local places are not our standard models of success. The place we call home in a technological era is increasingly the bedroom community from which we connect by internet or airplane with the people and issues that matter to us wherever they may be. Still, we long for home, for community, for roots, for a basic sense of belonging. And no one knows this better than our marketing firms. 1,000 times a day we are sold the experience of home, whether it's in a car, a bank, or a cup of coffee. We're invited to buy a little bit of that stability that we can't seem to find in a culture where most of us are always on the go. But when the gift we were made for is reduced to a commodity it cannot satisfy, a placeless culture threatens to hold us captive in the cyberspace of endless desire. But God's desire for us is still more powerful. Scattered though we may be by the desires of our twisted selves, God insists on meeting us in the particularity of our daily lives. The chaos of a blighted neighborhood is interrupted by a new Jerusalem now. The busy life of a contemporary churchgoer is confronted by words plainly spoken when you, their pastor, hold up a piece of bread and say, "This is my body, broken for you." These signs are not the norm in our world, but neither are they an anomaly in the story of God's people. Concrete interruptions, they point to the peculiar way that God is in the habit of breaking into our broken world. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Strange as it seems, God's incarnation in Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham and to Israel that God would make a home with us. God dwells with people in the particularity of our place and culture, not so we can learn to transcend these particularities, but so that we can know that our material lives have been redeemed. To stand with Jesus is to stand on holy ground. The places where we live matter because we are, each of us, invited to participate in the mystery of Christ's incarnation. The New Testament calls the church the body of Christ because it assumes that Jesus' incarnation on the ground that was hallowed by His presence is extended into all the earth through the flesh and blood of people who have died to themselves and found new life in the Spirit. That's what we were looking at in Ephesians yesterday. To live a life in Christ is to live in place, growing day by day into the fullness of the One who showed us how to engage our world faithfully. It is to pray not only with our words, but with our whole lives, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth, here as it is in heaven." So back to New Jerusalem now. This incredible community that's there in North Philadelphia. Standard recovery wisdom says that if you want to change habits, you have to change people, places, and things. If you've been around AA, you know this. When addicts return to their old environment, they easily slip into old patterns. Programs that effectively relocate people have a lower relapse rate. Recovery is always a long road, but it usually begins by getting folks out of the mess they were in. For folks who are shackled by addiction, freedom often looks like leaving. And while the wisdom of this is certainly part of the program at New Jerusalem now, everyone there begins with a 50-day blackout during which they have no contact with outsiders. They take seriously this need to cut off old habits. This community's presence in North Philadelphia is enough of a contradiction to raise a question. Why would people serious about recovery decide to stay here? Why does this place matter? Gary is a Lazarus. He inhabited the tombs of North Philadelphia for far more than 3 days, and he bore the stench to prove it. But over a decade ago, he was raised to new life at New Jerusalem now. He helps to run the program, a living testimony to folks who are just beginning that the dead are raised to life in this place. His presence raises the question that the Lord asked Ezekiel when he led him to an abandoned place littered with dry bones. Can these bones live? Resurrection is the hope that Israel's prophets point to, anticipating Jesus, not as a magic ball claims to know the future, but as a good composer knows where her song is going, because everything points in that direction. While a system of death lays claim to our lives and frustrates God's good creation, the constant hope of our story is that death does not have the last word. The same spirit that hovered over the waters at creation can rattle bones together and cover tendons with flesh, restoring life to a glory that even exceeds its original goodness. This is what we see in the resurrection of Jesus, but it's already there in the prophet Ezekiel, already breaking forth in the lives of Lazarus and Gary. Ours is one story, start to finish. So if we pay attention to Ezekiel, we also gain an appreciation for the way God's hope for us is tied to the land. In the chapter before the great Valley of Dry Bones passage, the Lord instructs Ezekiel to prophesy concerning the land. But you, O mountains of Israel, will produce branches and fruit for my people, Israel, for they will soon come home. I am concerned for you and will look on you with favor. You will be plowed and sown. It's an amazing... Just reading those chapters, it's an amazing thing to hear a prophet prophesying to the land. You know, we sometimes have the sense of shock when we hear the stories of Francis preaching to the birds. But Francis preached to the birds because people like Ezekiel had preached to the mountains. this is one creation. These tender words of care are spoken as to a dearly beloved child. They are the songs of a God who loves people and land alike, remembering that we are but dust that has been kissed by the eternal music of God. But God's words are not directed towards soil in general. They are for the particular land that was promised to Abraham, the mountain from which Israel had been exiled when Ezekiel prophesied. This land is holy in a way that other places are not, because God has promised to dwell among the people in this place, this particular place. To understand how God saves us all through one man, Jesus Christ, we have to internalize the peculiar logic of a God who blesses the whole world by calling one place holy. It is admittedly strange, and it is admittedly dangerous. I mean, go to the Holy Land. Something about this rubs most of us the wrong way. We prefer a franchise model. If you want to reach the whole world with an idea or a product, common sense says that you start with something that can be easily replicated everywhere. Don't get too caught up in the details and local particularities. The franchise model says focus on the big picture, right? On the things we all have in common. Cheap food that tastes good, appeals to most people. Put a logo on that concept, and with some good marketing, soon you'll have billions served. Why then does the God who so loved the world get all wrapped up in the particularities of Israel and their place rather than universalizing the principle of love? The answer, it seems, is tied up in the story that we have been given. Salvation is of the Jews, Michael Wishegrad writes, because the flesh of Israel is the abode of the divine presence in the world. It is the carnal anchor that God has sunk into the soil of creation. I love that line. It is the carnal anchor that God has sunk into the soil of creation. While we might speculate about other possibilities, the only story we know about our Creator is one in which Israel is this carnal anchor, sunk deep in Palestine for the salvation of us all. Incarnation, then, is not just about the second person of the Trinity becoming human. It's about Jesus getting born of a Jewish mama in Bethlehem of Judea. Our God does not offer a general and universal blessing on the world, but blesses the particular people of Israel in their particular place so that they can be a real blessing to all the nations of the earth. The good news that the church proclaims, then, is not a universalized spiritual message about our eternal status. It is always a particular invitation to become part of a placed people in the world. We are not a franchise with billions served. We are a body rooted in Israel,
called to hallow every place.
The church has struggled to internalize this from our very beginning. Paul, who began preaching the good news about Jesus in the synagogues of the Jewish diaspora, struggled to articulate a gospel for all people that was nevertheless, as he says in Romans, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. What was manifestly clear from his experience and later confirmed by the Jerusalem Council was that God was moving to gather Jews and Gentiles into a new kind of community. This was the same God who had chosen to dwell among the people of Israel since Sinai. But this God's particular presence was manifest in a radically new way. The same spirit that gave life to Jesus' body was now inhabiting the particular flesh of Jews and Gentiles in Jerusalem and Antioch, Ephesus and Corinth, Philippi and Rome. The reason he kept claiming this is because he saw it. You see, that's a striking thing. It's a striking thing if you read through Acts. The striking thing about the power of the resurrection is that the people who testify to the power of the resurrection, though they saw Jesus raised from the dead, many of them, that's not what they say is the evidence. Read through Acts. What they keep saying over and over again is we know Jesus is raised from the dead because there's these communities that are springing up everywhere where there are Jews and Gentiles living together. This strange new community wouldn't be possible unless Jesus is raised from the dead. Don't you know, Paul wrote to the early Christians living in Corinth, that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. As living members of Christ's body in the world, the church existed in the particular places of the first century world as a temple, hosting God's presence and hallowing ground that had formerly been devoted to other gods, or simply viewed as real estate, which might also be a devotion to other gods, but that's another point. When the blood of so many of those early saints was spilled out, they not only became martyrs in the church's memory, they, like Jesus, transformed the places where they worshipped and died. Their graves became holy ground, every bit as much as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Our resistance to God's way of engaging the world through particular people and places is not new. As the early church began to make sense of God's movement within the Greco-Roman world, its teachers recognized a tension between the deity that philosophers imagined and the God who took on human flesh in Jesus. Many of the early heresies of the church, Gnosticism, Docetism, Arianism, were attempts to make Jesus a little more spiritual and a little less bound up in the messiness of matter and the particularity of Israel. But Orthodoxy insisted again and again that the Jewish man Jesus was in fact the creator of the universe, the Word made flesh to dwell among us. Athanasius, who stood against the Arian heresy in the 4th century, he wrote that God, the God who impressed the divine image on humanity in the beginning, quote, secured this grace that he had given by making it conditional from the first upon two things, namely a law and a place. A law and a place. The grace that was refused by Adam and Eve in Eden was received by Abraham and Sarah in Israel. Though their faith was but the size of a mustard seed, it took root in such a way that salvation came to all the earth through their family in Jesus. From start to finish, grace is dependent on a place. So Jesus is not just the promised Son through whom all the world will be blessed. He is also, in his very Jewish flesh, the promised land that transforms every place. Early in John's Gospel, Jesus makes a navigational decision that would have stood out to Jews of his day. Y'all know about this. You know, rather than going straight to Jerusalem, or going around to Jerusalem, he goes straight through Samaria. This was something of a departure from the standard practice. This woman is as surprised by Jesus as John's readers would have been. But in the course of their conversation, Jesus and the Samaritan woman get around to talking about their people's argument about place. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. You see, this is a disagreement about where worship happens. Where is the holy ground? Just a normal person on the street, this woman is attentive to her people's connection to place. She knows place has everything to do with worship. Which is the true holy ground? She's asking. Jesus' answer is to the point. A time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. clearly this is a new day. Jesus' presence has radically altered the definition of holy ground. But Jesus has not come to break the promise of holy land. He is here to fulfill it. When Jesus says, a time is coming and has now come, and true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, we are quick to focus on the spirit that floats above real places, on a divine principle that can now be applied in every place. But the woman who has met Jesus is much closer to the truth of the ground. Remembering God's promise to Israel, she says, I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And Jesus responds that he is Messiah. He is the one who has come to fulfill God's promises. Yes, God is spirit, but the spirit that hovered over the Ark of the Covenant is now present in Jesus. He says, it's here. It's in me. God's spirit has a carnal anchor in the world. So the argument between the Samaritans and the Jews was about the presence of God's spirit in the Ark. Both groups had a memory of possessing the Ark in their place, yet after their return from exile, neither group could produce it. Neither could prove God's presence in the here and now. At this point in John's Gospel, the Spirit has descended upon Jesus at his baptism. You remember that scene? This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. The Spirit has come on the very person of Jesus. And it has claimed, Jesus has himself claimed, to be the temple. Right? Tear this down and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. The signs of the story tell us what John declares in his prologue. The Word has become flesh and made his dwelling here among us. So here in Samaria, with a woman at a well, Jesus makes clear how his incarnation redefines place. This woman is invited to worship God where she is, to see that she stands on holy ground, not because God is everywhere in some abstract sense, but because Jesus is here in the flesh. His presence has hallowed the ground. Wherever Jesus is standing with us, we can worship the Father in spirit and truth. Wherever we stand in Christ, we are about hallowing our place. All this is a long way of saying that where we live matters, because as living members of Christ's body, our vocation is to make true worship possible in our place. This worship is not, as the woman at the well first assumed, confined to a house of worship. Gathering places are needed, and it's a great gift to have a room or building devoted to prayer. But church buildings do not define holy ground for those who are in Christ. The ground we till to plant a garden, the streets connecting us to one another, the homes where we live, the shops where we work, the third spaces where we meet our neighbors, the forest where nature's rhythms are preserved, the abandoned lot that we overlook, all of these places are holy now. God wants to meet us here and to meet our neighbors through us. Monastic wisdom points us toward this understanding of being a placed people. The monos in monasticism is Greek for one. From the very beginning of their life in the church, monks sought to focus their full attention on one thing, to pray without ceasing, to marry Christ, to worship God in spirit and in truth. This is the monastic vocation. It exists as a gift to us all, to the whole church, as a concrete reminder that this is really all that any of us were made for. The whole point of human existence, as the later catechism taught us, is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. If we pay attention to the monastic witness, its radical focus reveals something about how true worship compels people to engage our places. While monasticism began as a movement of solitary prayer in the desert, it quickly took on a communal expression. Pilgrims who found hospitality in the early desert communities brought their wisdom back to cities, integrating a vision for true worship into the life of the whole church. And in Western monasticism, this wisdom was best summarized in Benedict's Rule, a document that not only shaped monastic spirituality, but the life of Western civilization. Giving themselves to the rules pattern of ora et labora, prayer and work, Benedictine communities became anchors of society in Europe during the Middle Ages, offering stability and life-giving compassion to those around them through turmoils that were unimaginably chaotic by our contemporary standards. While critics have rightly observed that some Benedictines were corrupted by the power that they amassed in Europe, their communities became a force in Western society while committed to nonviolence and gospel poverty. That's worth paying attention to when we're reflecting on powers. One of the strongest forces in Western society was an organization that was committed to nonviolence and poverty. They grew both in number and influence, not because they were eager to, quote, change the world, but because they understood their vocation to be the worship of God and an authentic engagement with local places.
For the Benedictine, worship required scripture, study, and prayer. But this commitment to the Opus Dei, the work of God, was always paired with a commitment to working the land and practicing the works of mercy. While the heritage of these communities includes beautiful manuscripts and time-honored prayer practices, we also have the Benedictines to thank for the modern university and hospital. Their work in education and healthcare instilled values in Western society that we now simply take for granted. Yet without the monastic witness, these institutions may well have never come to be. There certainly was not an assumption that hospitals existed for everyone before the monks, or that healthcare existed for everyone. It existed for people who could afford it, which some people still maintain today, but that's another point. To see the Benedictine witness as a sign pointing toward faithful engagement with our place is to see how true worship is always about prayer and work, an inward journey and an outward journey. Most of what Christians do in our worship gatherings is about inner work. We pray and study, fellowship and praise. But the work we do outside of these gatherings is also worship. When we care for our children or organize our neighborhoods, when we teach and care for the sick, when we welcome the stranger and feed the hungry, when we conduct business for the common good and create beautiful art, all of this is worship too. To find our rhythm as a people who gather to pray and to go out to work, all is a life of worship. It's to learn what it means to see our places as holy ground. Here's where this gets down to the congregation. I'm trying to think about what this means for folks who are part of a regular congregational life. In the history of the church, this way of understanding worship was wrapped up in the parish system. Strongly influenced by the Benedictine witness, Christians in the West understood themselves for centuries as members of the Church Universal in a particular parish. Church shopping would not have made any sense to these people. The congregation you belonged to was determined by the zip code where you lived. You were a member of your parish. This meant that the worship gathering of your faith community was in walking distance of your home. When you gathered with your brothers and sisters in Christ, you were gathering with your physical neighbors. In our contemporary language, everyone was a member of a neighborhood church. You're gathering with your neighbors, but also, this is important too, especially in our present context, you're gathering in view of your neighbors. The neighbors who aren't part of the church realize some of these neighbors they go over to this place. They do these things together. In this system, the vocation of the church to engage its particular place was clear. How particular individuals and groups engaged their place varied, of course, but that you were called to engage your village or neighborhood as a member of Christ's body was simply assumed. Those who worship the Father must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Even before this understanding of place was disrupted by modern technologies of mobility, it was fragmented by divisions within the church. When Catholics and Protestants could no longer worship together, one group ran the other out of town, or, after they had agreed not to kill one another, they set up two different parishes in the same place. The multiplication of denominational divisions that followed coincided with the rise of a consumer culture, resulting in a contemporary context where congregations compete for members but are not sure how to help the people they attract to engage the places where they live. For so many of us today, church is a place where you go on Sunday, just like work or school or home are the places we go every other day of the week. Where we live often has little to do with where we worship, and this makes it difficult to see how we're called to make our whole life true worship in a place. But incarnation interrupts us. To confess that Jesus took on flesh and moved into the neighborhood is to see that we are invited to dwell in our places and grow up into the fullness of Him who fills everything in every way, to quote that great flourish from Ephesians we read yesterday. As the letter to the church at Ephesus demonstrates so well, the power of God that raised Jesus from the dead is within us to overcome the principalities and powers of our present age. A culture of hypermobility is not greater than God's plan to redeem the world through Christ's body, the church. But Ephesians is equally clear that this power is made manifest in the peculiar way of engagement that we learn from Israel and Jesus. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that you may be able, I know we haven't gotten here in our Bible study yet, but we will, so that you may be able to stand your ground, stay in place. If we pay attention to the conquest stories of Israel, we learn that God's people did not gain their promised land through cunning or military might. They left Egypt through the Red Sea because God made a way out of no way, When they came to Jericho, it was God who made the walls come tumbling down. Israel's greatest hero, David, won his monumental battle against the Philistine giant Goliath by refusing the royal armor and trusting God to use the simple slingshot he carried as a shepherd boy. Over and again, God makes clear that Israel isn't in charge of securing its own place in the world. The Lord will fight for you, Moses says. You have only to stand still. This standing in place is the posture that the New Testament exhorts the church to maintain. Jesus told Peter, the rock upon whom he had promised to build his church, that he should put away his sword in the Garden of Gethsemane. The violence of this world's kingdoms would not be the means by which God would establish the peaceable kingdom here on earth. Jesus' refusal of worldly power is not, however, a passive submission to the status quo. Jesus stands before Pilate. Just as martyrs would stand before authorities after him, neither backing down nor succumbing to the way of an order that was passing away. Fight the good fight of the faith, Paul exhorted his young disciple Timothy, recalling that Timothy had made the same good confession that Jesus made while testifying before Pontius Pilate. What was that good confession? Do you remember what Jesus said before Pilate? Nothing. He just stood there. He stayed in place. The recovering addicts at New Jerusalem now, in North Philadelphia, cannot imagine their own redemption apart from the redemption of their place. They know in their bones that they must be born again. They know just as surely that they need new homes and new businesses, new manners and new friends, new food and new fun, a new heaven and a new earth. It is striking, though, that even as they are giving their whole selves to building a new society within the shell of the old, as Peter Morin used to say, they are equally committed to unlearning the habits of power and control that those who are apparently successful in our society often assume. Their alternatives to violence seminars, alongside their vigils against war and capital punishment, testify to the way that they are learning to fight the good fight of faith. To pay attention to their witness is to see how the transformation of our places depends on learning the peculiar way of standing that we see in the stories of Israel in Jesus. I think I'll stop there because Anna Grace is being gracious and not cutting me off yet. But I hope this is a way of pointing to how a community like New Jerusalem now interrupts our kind of easy assumptions about what it means to be church in this society in a way that actually helps us remember our tradition, right? And the convictions that ground our tradition. It seems to me that one of the gifts of the institution of the church has been to preserve a tradition that has been handed down. This is what I often say to these radical folks in new communities who are ready to ditch the institutional church. I say, look, everything you believe because you read the Bible. We wouldn't even have the darn book if it wasn't for the institutional church. I mean, you know, you got to give some thanks just for the people who learned the language and wrote it down on parchment for all those years, you know, that it was passed down. So we have the resources, I think, right there in the heart of the church, right there in the tradition that has been maintained. And yet, in some ways, I think it's the experiments that happen on the edges that point us back to what the tradition actually is about. So the institution has a way of forgetting. All of us have a way of forgetting. But we need reminders. And the good news is that God continues to interrupt us and to often interrupt us from the margins, from places like New Jerusalem now. And so what I'm trying to suggest is that one of the ways we're being interrupted in the present is by a reminder that the doctrine of the Incarnation is really about a call to be placed people in the places where we are. And I hope that has all kinds of implications for your congregations and dioceses and areas that you're ministering in. But we can talk together about what that could look like. So thank you. Do we have time for conversation now? Or are we?
Is I somewhere? rather become the timekeeper. You've got a whole half hour.
Oh, really?
Before a break.
Oh.
Breaks at 10:30.
Breaks at 10:30. I was thinking 10.
So we've just
got a lot of time. Oh. Well, we can start talking, or I could read you the last section that I skipped. Either way. Yeah.
Could you say something about what's going through my mind is the danger of kind of being too possessive of the space that you're in. I'm thinking particularly of Judea and Samaria as being kind of the country of Israel's kind of place that they're going to defend against all others, or a place that becomes so possessive that a congregation won't allow outside groups to use it. You know, how the place can also kind of bury us in that one place to such an extent that we no longer interact with what the context is.
Yeah. No, I think this is an incredibly important question. I come from a place in rural North Carolina where people actually do still love the place. I have an older brother. He's only 14 months older than me, so we grew up quite close to each other. My brother thinks I'm absolutely crazy for all kinds of reasons. But the main reason is because why on earth would anyone want to leave the place where we grew up? He has that deep in him. He can't imagine living anywhere else. Because our people are people who, for generations, have lived off the land there. And it's tough, red North Carolina clay. But, you know, he and I grew up working it in the field, and he loves it. And I love it, too. But the reason I left is because I began to realize, as just a kid who was reading the Bible, that our commitment to place was greater than our commitment to love. You know, we were racists. After I was born, in the town where I grew up, they took down the sign that said, "Don't let the sun set on your black ass," in King, North Carolina. It was right there on the state highway at the edge of town. And even though they took it down, because I'm sure somebody told them they had to, somebody from this, you know, from the government told them they had to, everybody still believed it. You know, we went to church at a place where some of the deacons were still members of the Ku Klux Klan. It's disturbing. It's disturbing to realize that the same people who are very kind to you when you're growing up and always pat you on the back and cheer for you at the baseball games also have people that they hate so much that they would burn crosses against them. Well, that stuff goes deep. But anyway, it has a lot to do with the dangers of stability, I think, and the danger of calling a place your own in a way that creates a kind of a fortress mentality. So one of the things that fascinates me about the Benedictine commitment to stability is that it's always paired with the commitment to hospitality. All of the Benedictine commitments are like this. We were joking back here. Earlier when Ina Grace was suggesting that people move around, they were joking that they were committed to stability, to which she replied, but you also need to be committed to obedience, because that's in the rule too, right? The Benedictines talk about the three vows, the vows of obedience, stability, and conversatio morum. It is in the Latin. It's sort of a conversion as a way of life, or the monastic way of life. It's a three-legged stool, they say. You kick out one of the legs and the stool falls over, right? And a lot of the Benedictine life has a balance in that sense. So they say the commitment to stability is its dangers are in part guarded against by the commitment to welcome every guest as if the guest were Christ. That means that, you know, to some degree the door is always open. Now, that doesn't take away the danger, but it means that there is something there to counterbalance it. And what I was trying to suggest here is that within the tradition of Israel and the church, I think that the nonviolence of God's way of love is actually also part of what counters the way that that holy land is actually being claimed in Palestine right now. I don't mean to suggest that great wrongs haven't been done on both sides of that conflict, but I'm deeply disturbed by Zionism, and by its insistence that Holy Land must be defended by military might, which is largely funded by our U.S. government. I think this is a deep problem that we are all involved in by virtue of our, you know, paying our taxes. And this is a, I think it's a big deal. What I'm looking for is, how do we read the story in a way that we don't succumb to this kind of temptation to extract a general principle? Or as the great Adolf von Harnack said, you know, to peel away, you know, the outside so that we get at the kernel of the gospel. And once we've gotten to the kernel, and once we've gotten rid of all that Jewishness and all that, you know, all those stories we don't like, once we have the kernel, then we can just preach that. All I think we've seen now, after about 100 years, the great error of that, there's something deeply modern, and I think deeply problematic about that. But you can understand why people turn in that direction if you understand the danger of particularity, the danger of place, the danger of people loving a land so much that they'll kill for it. In congregational life, I mean, I think you draw an important connection there between, you know, even loving a building can mean that, well, we struggle with this in our church. You know, people pay for that building. You know, they've worked for years for it, and so when the Urban Hope Summer Camp is going on, like it's going on right now, and all these kids come in, and these kids don't care a thing about the building, and they're throwing the chairs around and scraping the floor, and we're going to have to re-wax it, and then, you know, all that. That's going to cost $2,000. People talk like this, and I think that's the real tension that exists on the ground. Well, what does it mean? What does it mean to say that that building, as one, let's say, material manifestation of the church's body life in that place, that building is a gift that we have that's in service to our vocation in this place, right? Well, I think partly that means that in our place, we have to be deeply concerned with kids. We have lots of kids in our neighborhood who don't have parents. You know, they're being raised by grandmothers because, these are just deeply, deeply terrible stories. The little girl that's at my house every day, she's going into the third grade now. We see her mama every once in a while, and because she stays with her grandma, and her mama, when she's out of prison, comes around. But she never stays long because she's so addicted to crack cocaine. And you can see in her little girl's face both how excited she is to see her mama when she comes and how ashamed she is of her mama. These are the kids who are living in our place, and we're called to be the church in that place. We've got to have a ministry to these kids, right? So I'll make that case real strongly to the church. But then, you know, I'll also talk to the kids about how they do need to learn to respect the building. And as a matter of fact, you know, they can learn to help take care of it. I think, you know, we can work both sides of this thing. But it's the tension is always there. I think you're right. You've got your finger on it. It's there in geopolitical issues, and it's there in the local parish. Yeah. Go ahead.
You just put your finger on this, on the experimenting with the concept of congregational vocational amnesia.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
When a congregation has a missional vocation, it's pretty clear how they use their space, how they stand for it, mm-hmm. how they open it, but also protect it and respect it.
Yeah.
It's the times when the congregation has lost its missional call.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there just for the place to keep the lights on and so on. And you see especially mm-hmm. dying congregations just circling the wagons and saying, everything we do has to be about keeping this place open.
Right.
But there is no calling to the children in the neighborhood. Or when the missional vocation is remembered, then it's clear what the duty is.
Yeah. You know, I really like the way this missional language. You got to thank some of the people here for really stirring this up. They've been working for a long time, and it is getting out there into the churches. And I really do think it can be helpful to see the church as mission station rather than the church as fortress. That's how I've heard some people talk about it. Sometimes what I do see, though, and this is worth just pointing out, is this is trickling down into the churches. Sometimes the theology doesn't get there with it, so they get just the language without the theology. And sometimes what that means is that it's sort of mission post in the classical colonial model. So that we actually have a church that came to us. I'll go ahead and say it, since I already told you this is where I come from. It was a Southern Baptist church. But Southern Baptist churches in the South, you'll have to know this too, have stopped putting Southern Baptist on their signs. They come up with new names like The Journey or The Story or, you know, something community church, because they realize they've gotten a bad rap in some circles. Nevertheless, it's interesting that some of these churches have adopted the missional language. These folks who came to talk to us recently had adopted the missional language. Interestingly, though, they came to talk to us because they wanted to put, I think it was 15 of their college-age students in our neighborhood for a summer mission project. And they wanted to put it in our neighborhood because our neighborhood was a needy neighborhood. And it was the closest needy neighborhood to where their church building is. But they hadn't bothered to even come over and get to know anybody in the neighborhood until they had this project that they needed to have a place for the kids to go to. And they called it missional. And I gently tried to tell them that they should read Ina Grace's books. No, I gently tried to tell them that, you know, part of mission is this incarnation, is putting your flesh there, which means... I wrote them a letter afterwards. It was a hard conversation, because I think they thought we were attacking them. It was several people from our community. But I wrote them a letter, and what I said was that this really makes me sad for the church, that you have young people who you've articulated the gospel to in such a way that they realize it's an adventure that demands their whole life. These young people have come and said, we'll give you our whole life for a summer. Send us on mission. And I said, it's sad to me that the ministry you have isn't exciting enough to demand their whole life. So you're looking for somewhere to send them. You're a church, and you don't have anything exciting enough for people to give their whole life to when they come forward and give their whole life. I said, I'm sad. I said, but if you'd like to really, really work on that, I'd be glad to work with you, because I think your church could. You could have ministries that, you know, that people are giving their life to. But I'm disturbed by these things that want to stir up young people, because young people have energy, and then want to send them off somewhere, and they'll talk about partnerships with local stuff, but they don't have the partnerships until they have the young people who need something to do. And that's the thing that disturbs me. I'm sorry if I got up on my soapbox there, but go ahead.
Sorry, but I have a question and then a story to illustrate the question, because I'm not sure the question is clear yet.
Okay.
But the question is a church that refuses to engage the local a Christian church at all? And the story is, I live in Iowa. We were affected by the floods in 2008.
Yeah.
Two churches, a couple of blocks apart, one very immersed in its neighborhood, somewhat fortress mentality, but immersed. The church was underwater. It moved outside. It was hugging neighbors. It was getting stuff to neighbors. Very relational.
Uh-huh.
The other church, only the pastor showed up at the building because nobody lives there and nobody cares about that neighborhood. The church just happens to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The neighborhood changed around them. It had the audacity to change around them. And they call themselves a destination church.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is a destination church a Christian, exclusively destination church, a Christian church?
They call themselves a destination church. That's their name they have?
No, their name is Trinity, ironically. but what I'm saying is the pastor says, we're really not a neighborhood church, we're a destination church.
Mm-hmm.
I have such violent reaction against that, as you can probably imagine.
Yeah.
And I think we do too much We do too little engaging in our immediate neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And building relationships. You know, mm-hmm. if we do program and then resent the heck out of people for not participating.
Mm-hmm.
But that the relational work. So my question is just, I mean, can an incarnational faith manifest itself in churches mm-hmm. that are not engaged in the local?
Well, let me tell you a story from a very different context that might shed some. Of course, I agree with you, right? I mean, this is what I'm trying to say. But I want to hold on to hope too. So let me tell you, the reason we have destination churches in part is because of the extreme popularity of a particular model of church that grew up not too far from here in the western suburbs of Chicago. And so,
no names mentioned.
So several years ago, the Willow Creek Church did a survey of their congregation, and they were particularly interested in discipleship. You know about this? You know about the survey they did. What I'm actually impressed by is some of their follow up to the survey, because what they found, if you haven't seen it, is that while they were good at being attractional, at being a destination church that brought people in, they brought thousands of people in. You know, it was a good show. And that touched people in some ways that kept them coming. And so, you know, that had a certain value to it. They said that they were deeply concerned that that their model of church didn't seem to advance people in discipleship. And when they had started as a, you know, little group of college students who had, you know, kind of grabbed onto this vision of church as community, well, they had really hoped that it would change people's lives. So a lot of the leadership there was deeply concerned. Well, one of the things they did that I really appreciate is they started a church plant here in the city, and they put the money up. Like, they really made it happen in a way that that your denominations might, or, you know, your district or something might, you know, really back something and make it happen. They are an association themselves, right? This is a pretty big organization. And I know the pastor of that church, and I'm pretty impressed by what they've been able to do in terms of becoming a neighborhood church. They've been at CCDA, which is the Christian Community Development Association. They've been there every year for the past 5 or 6 years since they started. They're really trying to educate their people who come, because they do get some of these kind of Linkin Park type city livers, you know, who are sort of you know, urban hipsters living in neighborhoods, and people in the urban context worry about gentrification and things that happen with this sort of crowd. But they're really trying to have these people listen to the wisdom of someone like John Perkins, right? Who's one of the saints of neighborhood based community development in this country, and so I only say that to say that while I have like you lots of trouble with the attractional or destination church, it does seem to me that even the people in those places that are continuing to try to pay attention to the gospel are seeing that there's a need for something else, just by virtue of the fact that doesn't pay off on what they hope for.
Well, and unlike Willow Creek, this congregation I'm referring to is located in one of the poorest neighborhoods, most flood affected, and just sort of checked on themselves and said, our folks are okay.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll have to say, as
had no neighborhood.
Yeah. As a minister in the black church, I'll have to say this is very common in our churches. We go to Martin Luther King's home church in Atlanta, and they got a big, nice building right there in the neighborhood that almost everybody drives in. To the extent that in most of these kind of churches now, there's actually a ministry of the church that is supervising the parking lot during the service so that nobody breaks into the SUVs. That happens at a lot of urban churches, and those are often African American churches, and that's problematic too. That's problematic too.
Well, it goes back to this hypermobility and just the whole development of our even the interstate highway system, I was a district superintendent in Memphis, had 44 churches. And when they tried to take I-40 through the center of Memphis, they got it about halfway through and they stopped at Overton Park.
Yeah.
And they fought over that for 20 years. But what it did was it displaced whole neighborhoods and created this natural boundary. And it created this dilemma that all the churches had to become destination churches over time because physically their whole neighborhood was disrupted and people were moved, literally houses bought and moved out.
Yeah.
So you have this phenomenon in the whole city of Memphis then that most people drive to a destination church. So after about a 40-50 year period of that legacy, you have these churches that don't know how to do church.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge, huge problem. Huge problem. Very, very big challenge. To kind of relearn, rather than the fortress mentality or destination church that a couple of generations have lived with, relearning how to do church in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to spend a little bit more time with this afternoon, but just to kind of note it now, I think this is one manifestation of the way the church easily succumbs to the power of what we usually call realism, which is that the way the world is simply the way it has to be. So we've got to figure out how to do church within it, right? And that's why, I mean, you know, this story in Memphis is the story of urban development in the South for the past 40 years. This is fascinating. There was a study done on this a few years ago by a scholar at the University of North Carolina. If you look at the median income of African Americans and white folks in the United States in 1960, so before the sort of great achievements of the Civil Rights Movement, the difference between the median incomes, that difference is exactly the same today as it was in 1960. The median. Right? Now, the Oprah Winfreys and the Barack Obamas are the exception. But the median is the same. And what this study found was that the main reason the median hasn't changed in basically two generations of people is that there has been a generational destruction of wealth in city and interstate highway planning.
Absolutely.
All through the South.
Absolutely.
So that families that actually own property had an airport built or a highway built or some other structure built in such a way that it destroyed the value of their property so they didn't pass it on to their children. That's an incredible thing in our society that that black folks are deeply aware of, even if they haven't read that study. You know, they know that because they know, you know, Uncle Harry's story and, they know these stories. So, I think the realism that says we just have to figure out how to make things work in the world that is, I think Ephesians is calling us to interrupt that logic with this peculiar way of engaging the powers that we learn in Jesus. So it's an interruptive type behavior that is going to have to make some people say, those Christian folk are crazy. Those folk at that church are crazy. Obviously, that's not going to work, right? And Lord, it might not. I mean, you know, Jesus dies. Everybody stood around after that and said it didn't work. Shoot. You know? They were all huddled around in the upper room crying about how it didn't work when he showed up. And I suspect, you know, we might end up doing some of the same. Trying stuff that... I can't tell you how many things I've tried that they're still thousands of dollars in the hole. And I get together with the little boards and whoever who's responsible for them, and I say, doesn't look like it's working. Sorry about that.
Oops.
But that creates a space where resurrection can happen. And what are we if we're not people called to do that? Yeah.
Try to understand the canvas you painted. I'm trying to bridge my understanding with yours, and I look at the historical record of your writing, your historical context with what Moses said, just stand, and
So are you saying it's always a time of being passive, passively standing, or do you believe it's a time for war, a time to stand, even with the armor that we've been given?
That's a good question for the sixth chapter of Ephesians.
Right. Sixth chapter. Is that with Moses, and as he led them out of Egypt, they had spent 400 years in slavery. They were not trained in the art of war, but under Joshua, they would learn to fight and even depossess and destroy and annihilate cultures completely as they went to possess the land that God was giving them, as God told them to do so. Peter, what you need to note also is that when Christ told him to put his sword away, Peter often misunderstood what Christ was about and what he was trying to do, what he was working toward, which is why he had to tell Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," because Peter was going to stop Christ from doing the very thing he came to do. But he had a sword. Why? It wasn't for peanut butter and jelly. And further with Christ, if he had spoken and Pilate believed and came to understand who he was, there's no way he would have had him put on the cross. And so that would have derailed the entire plan that God had from the beginning. And then further with Ephesians, I think what Paul's trying to get us to see is that it's not just to stand, because otherwise we would have no need for armor, shield, and a sword. What Paul brings us to is that we're at war with these powers and authorities, that Christ has already won victory for us, but as yet it hasn't happened completely, and we are still at war with in the church today. It's not with each other, but these unseen forces that we're battling against. Yeah. But do you believe it's always a call to passiveness? I'm trying to understand the pain that you put forth.
That's a series of very good questions that we could spend some time sorting through, but I appreciate you thinking so carefully about it, because what you've touched on there is a good bit of the church's long tradition of reflection on just war. And I really want to address this some tomorrow morning, so I'll save some of it for then. But I would want to make the distinction between being passive and being committed to gospel nonviolence. I think it's an incredibly important distinction, because I think you're absolutely right. None of us can consider being passive as what God wants us to do in the midst of the things that are going on in the world. Indeed, I believe being passive is a way of just supporting the status quo in a way that's deeply violent in our world. So one of the most violent things you can do is to do nothing. But the nonviolent love that we learn from Jesus and his willingness to go to the cross, I think, is a willingness to interrupt the status quo, to interrupt the world as it is, in a way that that frankly looks crazy to the world as it is. Think, for example, about the Birmingham campaign in the midst of the civil rights movement. You know the letter from the Birmingham jail because you had to read it in high school, and the context of that was that they were trying to organize against a very publicly oppressive, proudly oppressive regime in Birmingham. Bull Connor wasn't the kind of segregationist we have had in North Carolina. North Carolina has always had a public face of good race relations, while white people quietly did things to put people down. But here was somebody who said, segregation is our way of life, and we're going to defend it. And so they were trying to organize against that in the Birmingham campaign. It was just before Easter, and these were mostly black church pastors who were sitting around planning. They were talking about what they were going to do, and they were saying that we're probably going to have to go to jail, but we're looking at the Easter weekend, pastors. This is the Easter weekend. How's a pastor going to go to jail, on Good Friday? And he's not even going to get to see the judge till Monday morning. So all the pastors sit around and say, this is the time it's all wrong. And Martin King actually got up, left the room, went and prayed for a while, came back and said, I'm going to jail. So he wrote the letter from Birmingham jail on that Easter weekend from Birmingham jail. You know that letter. Well, the thing is, he did get out early in the next week, and when he got out, absolutely nothing had changed. So here's going to the cross, and you realize, shoot, it didn't work. So again, they're sitting around in the meeting saying, what are we going to do? It didn't work. They had a clear
goal of what they wanted, right? They wanted Connor to come to the table and have a discussion about what could actually change in Birmingham. And he was not willing to. And pastor going to jail on Easter weekend didn't mean a darn thing to him. He wasn't going to change. They're sitting around in the meeting, and the way the story's told, I believe it was John Lewis who came in and said to this meeting of pastors, you know, elders of their community, who, if you know anything about the Black Church, I mean, they're really fathers of the family. That's what it means to be the pastor. They're sitting around, and in these young guys, a couple young guys come in and say, we've been having youth meetings, and the youth want to march. Think about yourself as the father of these little kids. You know how nasty this guy is. King's just been in jail. He knows how they treated him. And these kids are saying they want to march. And they said, okay, let them march. And that's what won the Birmingham campaign. It was the nation seeing Bull Connor stick dogs and fire hoses on little kids. And people looked at that and said, that can't be right. But my goodness, to be in the position of making that, there's nothing passive about sitting in that meeting and making that decision. I think that's a radical commitment to the peculiar way of Jesus that is that's active and that will cost you absolutely everything, but is deeply committed to the belief that God can make a way out of no way. That's how we say it in that tradition. God can make a way out of no way. And if the Lord is moving for the kids to march, let them march.
Start back up at 11 o'clock.